Grab a coffee or a tea, kick back and relax. We are traveling Japan without ever leaving home. This is episode 5 of The At Home Show. I'm Norm, this is the Tokyo Lens Podcast, and welcome to The At Home Show. As always, if you're a regular listener, welcome back. In 2005, when I took my very first trip to Japan, I based myself at the beginning of the trip out of Tokyo and did a bunch of smaller day trips. One of the day trips that stood out to me the most was actually the area that we are going today, up the coast to an area called Sendai, the largest city in Tohoku, a place that gives access to beautiful mountain shrines, stunning coastal boat trips. But the thing that really stood out to me in this area was the people and the experiences that I had. And this is just a little bit of what we are going to be talking about today with our guest who lives right in Sendai. And over the last year or so, today's guest and I have gotten a lot of tweets and requests for us to do a podcast episode together. But we thought that before we get into a really serious podcast episode where we dive deep into a topic, it might be nice just to kick back at home, relax. And so today we're at home with Chris. Also, being that it's Chris, just a little bit of a language advisory on this one. You have been warned. Let's get started. All right, so I am sitting here with Chris Broad of the Abroad in Japan channel. How's it going, Chris?
It's going well. I've only had my second coffee of the day, and I'm halfway through it. And so let's see what happens. I usually need like 2 or 3 coffees to become a human. When I get out of bed in the morning, it's like a 90-minute process to becoming alive. And I'm halfway through that process, given I've only woken up about an hour ago.
Fantastic. I was about to be like, what time did you wake up today? About an hour ago.
Too late.
For the 3 people listening to this who are like, I don't know who Chris Broad is, would you give us a little bit of an introduction to yourself?
I am the happiest person in the world. I smile obviously so much. And no, I'm basically a British guy that moved to Japan, teach English, taught English for 3 years, kind of got a bit boring after that, started YouTubing as a hobby in my first month that I moved to Japan, that kind of took off, became a YouTuber, and lived happily ever after. And then one day, in about 2017 or 2018, I met Norm, and my life changed forever. That's my story so far, basically, isn't it? When did we meet? I can't remember. When did we meet? Was it 2018?
It might have been 2018.
I don't know.
I know there was coffee involved,
was
much like now.
Coffee involved. And we kind of hang out like every, 2 or 3 months. We tend to see each other. We did a road trip back in October. We hung out in Tokyo, I think, in February or December. So we see each other every few months. Find an excuse to hang
despite
out.
The distance, we make it work. It's usually crammed in. And
when you say the distance, all of my friends in Tokyo always think, wow, you live in Tohoku, that's so far away. But it's a 90-minute bullet train ride, right? So to me, that feels like nothing. And I have friends living in Chiba and the outskirts of Tokyo, and it takes them longer to get into Tokyo than it does for me. You can get from Sendai to Tokyo Station on the bullet train 90 minutes. So I've never really felt like that. There's that much of a distance with that in mind.
No, I don't think so either. Actually, recently in the past year, I've done Sendai twice as a day trip and was amazed at just how close it really is.
Absolutely. And I think for a lot of people living in Tokyo, obviously, it doesn't include you, given you do travel a fair bit. Most of my friends in Tokyo just never leave it, because Tokyo is like a bubble, isn't it? 36 million people. It's a city so big, you can't see the bloody edge of it. And so it does feel like its own bubble. When I'm in Tokyo, I know I feel like I'm almost in a different country to when I'm out roaming in the countryside, you know. So, I think that's a real shame. I do try and encourage my friends to come out as much as I can. But obviously it's been a bit difficult at the moment, what with the bloody virus situation. But it's been a bit rubbish all around, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's kept a lot of us locked indoors, but it has opened up opportunities like this where I can say, hey, when are you available? And you're like, literally always. I'm sitting at home with coffee. So it has made for the opportunity for us to create some content and share some stuff. And I think this is a good opportunity for us to kind of share travel stories vicariously through this moment. Let the audience, if you will, live vicariously through the travels, because there are few people I know in Japan who have traveled more than yourself. Mm. Pretty much everywhere we go or everywhere we talk about, you're like, I have a story from there. Except for that cave. That was new discovery all around.
Yeah, so Norm and I took a road trip. It was me, you, Charlotte, Victor, my friend Dave, and we did a road trip, started in Morioka. We kind of curved around the coastline, the Sunriku coast, and there, somewhere between Morioka in the middle of nowhere, we found that really cool beach, didn't we? And there's a really beautiful cave, and I got a great shot of you, which I think should be your profile photo for everything. It's like Norm standing in a cave with his silhouette against the kind of afternoon sky. And it was amazing. I'd love to go back there. It's about, you know, 3 or 4 hours... about 3 hours from where I live by driving, but you know, I've been trying to stay in as much as I can at the moment. But the first chance I get, we're going to go out there and walk along that beach. It's also a little bit cold still, so. But yeah, no, we've travelled a fair bit, and
I think it was called like Usui Dangai or something like that. I feel like that's wrong.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It's a good time, didn't we? We went to Hachinohe. We saw the night market.
Yep.
The night market with the cool lady, and we went to Aomori, and I don't remember what else we did. Oh, we went to a lake and got a drone.
Yeah, went to a lake. Oh. It was beautiful weather that day. I was actually really surprised. So when we were heading up there, we were just trying to figure out fun stuff to do, and you were saying that we should check out the night market. And I thought, okay, you know, I don't really do night markets. Why not check it out? And did the night market, and there, as you said, there was the fun lady. That little shop, if you will, with the senbei jiru, which is, for those of you who don't know, it's like soup that has Japanese rice crackers in it. It was probably the single, outside of Natsuki, the single most photogenic Japanese individual I've ever had on the channel. She was so ready to just be a character.
I don't even know her name. I just know her as Horse Lady, because when I went up and did a video first with Ryotaro 2 or 3 years ago, we went to the night market. She was the one, we kicked the video off there in her shop. And obviously the senbei jiru, the rice cracker soup, is the main thing she does. But I think she gave us some sort of horse dish, because there's a lot of horse food from a neighbouring town called Gonohe. It's famous for horse, if you like horse. But she became the horse lady. And so that's all I know as the horse lady. But you too can meet the horse lady if you go to Hachinohe and check her out. She's unmissable, because she's the loudest, most charismatic one, isn't she?
Yeah, and actually almost every single customer who was at that shop that day, and there had to be 8 or 9 customers, is now friends that I still chat with.
No way, really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Like almost on a monthly basis, I exchange messages with them. And then that was terrible English. Exchange messages with them back and forth. Well, so
when you go to a shop that's run by someone as charismatic as the horse lady, you know, the customers are also pretty charismatic and fun as well, right? So it's like a magnet. Good bars attract good people. So that's tip number one of the Tokyo Lens podcast. Go to good bars and get drunk and meet horse lady. Yeah.
There's a place that I always recommend in Tokyo. It is a Rastafarian themed bar in Asakusa called Rastaman's Cafe. And it's about half the size of my little office that I have here, but is run by some of the most interesting people you'll ever meet. And I've actually stopped going there as much recently, simply because I, bit by bit, am running out of time for new friendships and new relationships. And every single time I go there, I meet someone new and awesome who just makes their way onto my Rolodex and into my circle.
That's awesome. You should make a list of like your favorite bars and restaurants in Tokyo, because I get asked it so much, and I don't really have a list. of places that I think are the best, but that is exactly the sort of place that I think people would be interested in. So you should make like Norm's Guide to Tokyo Nightlife or something.
Yeah, that actually, I did like an Asakusa video many, many years ago when I first started the channel, back when every video I made was for some reason louder than it needed to be, but I should revisit the series. But outside of the topic of Tokyo, so you have chosen, despite all of the travel that you do, and despite all of the YouTube work that is available in a place like Tokyo, for example, to live and build a life in northern Japan, centered out of Sendai. And I think the question that I personally have never asked you is the most simple and basic of all questions, which is, why?
Well, I don't think I could ever live in Tokyo, because when I'm there for more than 2 weeks, I start to feel a bit on edge. Like, I just don't enjoy crowds. I was raised in the countryside, so I've never really liked cities that much for extended periods of time. But when I came here to teach, I was placed in Yamagata, right, which is about as far away from anywhere as you could possibly imagine. And I built up a lot of friends in Tohoku, and I felt like I wanted to keep that connection. I did consider, after leaving Yamagata, I considered like two or three locations. One was Sendai, one was Kansai, I wasn't sure where, probably somewhere on the outskirts of Osaka. And one of them was like Fukuoka, on the outskirts of Fukuoka. And Sendai won, just by virtue of the fact that good friends up here, like Natsuki, my friend Yuki, I met Ryotaro as well, and he kind of convinced me that Sendai was good. But it's got the best of both worlds. You've got easy access to Tokyo. It is a city, so you've got everything you could possibly want. But in 20 minutes, you can either get to the Pacific coastline or you can get to the mountains and go skiing, which I never, ever do. But it's that feeling of you can hop in a car and just in 20 minutes you can be somewhere alone in the mountains, rice field scenery, perfect. And that, for me, that is the essence of what makes Japan great. It's not the cities, it's the countryside. And I feel it's a real shame that not many people see that, because most travellers coming to Japan go Tokyo, Kyoto, Hiroshima, Osaka, whatever, but they never do get to see places like Tohoku. So, and I think that gave me an additional sense of purpose, right? I have a purpose being in Tohoku. I'm here to try and get people to come and see it. Japan's best kept secret, which I'm sure you'll probably agree with, given you've spent quite a bit of time up here recently. You know, what do you think about Tohoku? What's for you? How do you feel about it?
Tohoku actually has a weird, special place deep inside of my heart, because when I first came to Japan, my very first trip ever, I spent 2 days in Tokyo, and then I decided that I wanted to see the cherry blossoms, and it was just too late to see them in Tokyo, so I had my Japan Rail Pass and decided to hop on a train and head up to Sapporo area.
Oh, wow.
But on the way up, I kept stopping and getting off the train and waiting for the next bullet train to come so I could like check out the area. Cool. And then when I first, then I came back to Tokyo, and then my next major trip was actually out to Sendai. And that was like my first big, I guess my first solo travel was Sapporo, and that I was, you know, first solo travel ever. I was terrified. Actually, I was so afraid, because you got to keep in mind, there were no smartphones, no Google Maps, nothing at that time. So when I got out of Sapporo station, I was so afraid of not being able to find the station that I kept like going one block up and then making sure I knew where the station was and then exploring and doing that bit by bit till I got to Odori Park. But once I gained comfort, my first solo trip was Sendai.
Nice.
And it was the first place in Japan where I made friends. I wanted to do the Matsushima boat tour.
Oh, yeah.
And so I went out to that area. I got out. I went the wrong way and ended up at this shrine that had this long set of stairs. And this older gentleman came up to me and was like, "Do you speak English?" And I was like, "Yes, yes, I do." And he's like, "Do you have time?" And I'm like, for what? He's like, "I'd like to teach you about this shrine." And I'm like, "Absolutely." He walked around, showed me around the shrine for a good half an hour or so. He got me lunch. We had lunch together. He took me into a museum. And then it turns out his friend runs the boat tour. So he saw me off to there. And the boat tour, I don't remember if I got it for free or if I got a discount, but it was like the first time that I had completely bonded with a person in Japan. Was right there in Sendai.
You lucky devil. I never get that. The only time people approach me to do anything is when it's like, where are you from? And I'm like, oh, you know, England. And they're like, oh, do you like religion? And I'm like, that's all right, isn't it? And they're like, I've got a special temple, a special shrine we should go and see. And it's usually some sort of cult, either a Christian cult or a Buddhist cult. And they try and lure me off somewhere. So you get a free bloody tour and all the greatest thing, and I get nothing. So I don't know why that is. I've never gotten much like that. So clearly, maybe it's because I don't look happy when I'm walking around, whereas maybe you have a cheeky smile on your face as you stroll the streets.
That is big, though, right? Like when you're fresh in the country, when you have what I call that fresh foreigner smell, and you've got your like backpacking backpack on and your like clothes that say like, I am dressed like this for 4 days at a time, and just that stupid smile on your face because everything is new. I think you let off a certain atmosphere that makes you much more approachable, because no one approaches me anymore. But my first trip to Japan was riddled with it. But outside of that, obviously, with playing Tsugaru Shamisen, the Aomori area is a special area to me. And it's an area that I go each year for the Shamisen competition. It's held in Hirosaki. And pretty much every Shamisen player from around the country gathers and competes in May.
But Hirosaki is a very nice place. One of my favourite towns, actually, in Aomori. Have you ever had the cider at Hirosaki? Because it's famous for its apple orchards. Obviously, Aomori is famous for apples in general, but Hirosaki's got some really good cider. So you could play the shamisen and get wasted at the same time. The most delightful beverage.
It's a dangerous combination. Yeah. It was actually the first place that somebody ever asked me if I wanted to warm up my onigiri.
Wow. That's yeah. Good.
Do they do that in Sendai?
Sometimes, if it's the one with the beef in it, then you get that. Mm. But otherwise, no. So
yeah, up in Hirosaki, they're like, "Would you like to microwave your own onigiri?" Wow. Like,
it does taste better. So. It tastes better. Tip number two of the Tokyo Lens podcast: heat up your onigiri. It's much better. There you go.
Yeah. Especially if it's like a day old onigiri, right? Like if it's been sitting in the fridge for a day, and you know you're worried about that dry rice, just. Ugh. Outside of the Tohoku area, though, I'm partial personally to Shikoku, but that can be pushed aside for
now. No, I like.
Do you have
Shikoku
an area
well.
That you?
I'm a big fan of Matsuyama, which I know you go to frequently. I'm not just saying that because I know you go there. Like, oh, I like Matsuyama as well. No, I actually really like Matsuyama. I've been there twice, and it's for those that don't know, it's a kind of a city on the north of Shikoku, and you can actually get to Hiroshima. On the ferry in about an hour, or you can cycle to it across the Shimonami Kaido, which is the best thing to do in Japan. About 70 kilometer cycle across the inland sea of Japan.
Beautiful.
Absolutely.
Too.
It's the most beautiful part of Japan for my money. But Matsuyama, I've been there twice, and it's always left a really good impression because it's got like the best view, I think, one of the best views in Japan in a city, and that's from Matsuyama Castle, which is obviously about 200 meters. Matsuyama Castle's right in the middle of Matsuyama. And when you go up there, you have to ride like a, what is it? It's like a ski lift, isn't it?
Yeah, a ski lift
to get up there. But the view, especially in the right season, is glorious. You're surrounded on all sides by the city. You've got the mountains on one side, the inland sea on the other. And I think it's just a magical place. And the people there are really great. And the yakitori, for some reason, yakitori there, the grilled skewered chicken, it's always the best. So I think if I had to live anywhere, like if I was to start over tomorrow and live somewhere completely new, Matsuyama would be it, because there's lots of places I haven't seen in that region of Japan, but it's kind of alluring and exciting. Although the insects would worry me. More spiders.
Yeah. So have you seen what Japan calls Iegumo?
You have to build on that. I don't know what it is. Iegumo.
Iegumo. So in Australia, they have the giant huntsman spiders, the ones that hang out. They're like hand size, and they hang out up in the corners. The very first time I ever saw one of those in my life was not during my time in Brisbane, but rather my time in Matsuyama.
Well, all right.
They are fast.
Ignore the bit.
I was so surprised, but everyone was like, yeah, we just call those Iegumo or house spiders.
Oh dear, ignore the bit a minute ago about me living in Matsuyama. Just brush that aside. That won't be happening now. That's killed that. I don't do spiders. So stuff that. No. Other than that, Matsuyama's great. Hidden Japan.
And very similar to Sendai. It's got that 20 minutes to the mountains, 20 minutes to the ocean, 30 minutes on the highway in either direction, and you're in a totally different place.
Yeah. Right? So. And because Japan is pretty well connected, you can just fly to Tokyo in about an hour or so, right? So
yeah.
Yeah. I think because Japan isn't that big, you can fly pretty much anywhere in the country in 90 minutes maximum.
Yeah.
And because we now have low-cost airline carriers, which is the greatest thing ever, you can get around for like... from Sendai to Osaka, it costs about 4,000, 5,000 yen, about 50, yeah. $40, $50, which is incredible value. So, but not many, I think not many foreign travellers do that, and I really recommend it. If you've got an extra bit of time to kill, then if you're in Tokyo and you've got an extra few days, have a day trip somewhere. Fly to like Sapporo for like one night and then come back. And you can see Sapporo in like 48 hours. So I always try and champion that, the idea of having these sort of 24-hour, 48-hour escapes to different cities, like Sapporo, Matsuyama, Fukuoka. Do that. That's tip number three on the Tokyo Lens podcast. It's great value for money.
Basically, we've covered areas like Sapporo and Sendai and, you know, Matsuyama and all of that. The Kyoto's and Osaka's being other great spots. But the areas that I think a lot of people don't venture to until maybe the second or third trip to Japan that I've found can be just as worth it are the areas that line the Sea of Japan, the northern shore of Japan, if you will. There are some beautiful spots that really give you... would I say a different feel than the sides on the Pacific coast? Out in Ishikawa, for example, there's a small peninsula called the Noto Peninsula. Have you ever heard of it?
I have, because when I went to Kanazawa City, they've got a really nice market. And one of the things they sell there is Noto beef. And I think that's the most inconvenient, ridiculous name. Is that beef? It's a Noto beef. What? Is it beef or not? It's not all beef. Give me the... Is it beef or not? And it's just... That's how every conversation happens. It's not all beef. It's not or it is. And that's the main problem. But anyway, carry on. It's good though. Do buy it. Tastes good.
All I could think of is who's on first. Yeah. Like the entire time you were doing that. I had gone out there a while back for... to do a mini tiny 1 to 2 day documentary on an area out in Noto that there's no young people left. There's like none. They're all gone. And so what they're doing to revitalize the area is to rent out all the normal homes, the farm homes, the old abandoned homes, like everything is turned into minpaku, which can, I guess, be compared to Airbnb, where like people just rent out their own home.
Kind of.
But there are even schools that you can rent out.
What?
So you could sleep in an abandoned school, basically, that has been reformatted.
Abandoned school. Noto. I'm looking for stuff like that. That'd be quite fun. Is it creepy?
Not entirely. It's actually like when you get in there, you're like, okay, this is very obviously like an old Japanese elementary school. And they wouldn't let us into any of the rooms because each had guests at the time. But it just feels like you're in an elementary school, except each classroom has been converted into a bedroom.
That's really cool. That is really cool. I'll have to check that out. Like, that is another part of Japan I've yet to explore that much. There's like three or four places. That's one of them. Shikoku's another. And Tottori. You ever been to Tottori? Seen the sand dunes?
Yes, Tottori. Yes. It's so nice.
Like, people don't know that Japan has... I mean, to call it a desert, I think, is a stretch of the imagination. But it has sand dunes, right, that look pretty grand. And if you frame it at the right angle, it does look like the Sahara Desert. I'd love to go there. Was it worth it? Was it overrated, underrated? What are your thoughts on it?
I didn't actually know about the sand dunes when I was going through. I had no idea. So I find out about it later and you just feel frustrated and oblivious. And have you been up to Toyama?
Yeah, on journey across Japan, we passed through it briefly and had the black ramen, which is just this ramen that's really thick soy sauce. It's so salty, though. If you don't like salt, it's like just drinking someone take like a salt shaker, put a few drops of water in and bang, that's it. That's what we did in Toyama. Other than that, no, I don't really know much about it.
So, Toyama, there are two amazing things that I highly recommend in Toyama that can just make a trip up there spectacular. But what we're going to do is we're going to talk about that after the break. Super quick break from this episode with Chris so that we can reset our cameras and grab some coffee, and so that I can let you know that there are actually video versions of all of these at-home show podcasts, as well as an entire separate secret podcast available over on Patreon. If you are interested in joining, I have left the link in the description of this podcast episode. I'd love to have you there. We have a lot of fun over on that side of things. But with all that being said, our cameras are reset, our coffee cups are full, and we're going to jump right back into the episode. All right, welcome back. So before the break, we were talking about the area of Toyama, I believe, and two of the big reasons that I recommend going out there. The first and foremost is one that people don't even think about or realize, and that's Chris sneezing. Brilliant. It's just spectacular. Brilliant. In Toyama.
It's coronavirus. Oh, no, it's finally caught up to me.
Oh, geez.
Or it's hay fever. You just
went for it. There's no hesitation. There's actually some of Japan's most beautiful mountain paths for exploring are out in Toyama. There's a photographer or two that I follow who live in the area who post like shots that you wouldn't even think are Japan. It doesn't look anything like Japan. It looks like the Swiss Alps or something more.
I think I know the photographer. Shots. I think I actually follow them because it might have come up because you recommended it. They're often of the mountains, right? Because Toyama is next to the Japanese Alps, which is one of the highest mountain ranges in Japan, about 3,000 meters. And they're absolutely stunning. And I regret not being near them more often. You went round there to do your video on the statues, though, didn't you? The creepy head statue.
And that's the second one, yeah. Yeah.
Beat you to it.
So last year, Victor and I decided to do what was originally called it was supposed to be the Abandoned Adventure. We changed it to the Unnamed Adventure because while everything had an abandoned feeling, actually every single place that we went to was still well cared for and taken care of. And so the Abandoned Adventure just didn't fit, and we weren't about to start breaking into places for the sake of YouTube. But one of the places that we hit was the village, I can't even remember the name of it now, the village with all the human statues. And while it looks like it's been there forever, the huge shock to us was that a lot of the people who are portrayed in these stone statues are still alive.
God, trapped inside the statues?
One would hope not. But it's been kind of a dream to do a follow-up on that project. I want to go back and I want to learn more about, for example, Doi Station and why in the world is it so deep underground, and why does the second train line run above ground, or those statues? Why, like, I'd love to meet or interview one or two of the people who have been portrayed in those statues.
I've known about these places for years. I've always wanted to go, and I was quite jealous when he went, and heartbreaking when I wasn't invited. But your videos were really good, actually. You did cover both of them really well, so I'm reluctant to go and do it. If something's been done really well, you kind of feel like, yeah, I don't know if I could be bothered now. I feel like it's already been done well once. But I do still want to see the statues. I know they're in the middle of nowhere. I know it's quite a journey to go on to just see some statues, but it might be worth it. Would you recommend I go?
You know, we almost hit up your, yes, 100%. I'm gonna loop back to that and touch on the point that you made before that, which is when you feel something's been done really well, you're a little more reluctant to do it. And Victor and I talked for a great deal about whether or not we were going to visit the cave that Joey abandoned you in. And we, I believe it was Joey, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You mean the tunnel?
The creepy cave.
Tunnel in Niigata.
Yeah, the tunnel. Oh, yeah. The creepy tunnel, yeah.
That was pretty creepy.
And Victor's like, oh, I know a whole bunch of information about that that would really make for a good story, a good video. And we talked about it back and forth, and we were like, nah, it's already been done really well. Like, it's been covered. We'll leave it for a couple of years, and then, you know, maybe it'll be rediscovered. But
yeah.
The statues were good. We hit them up specifically at 4 o'clock in the morning,
Jesus.
Just so we'd be able to have that creepy atmosphere before the sun comes up. We actually got graced with a gorgeous day that day, and them in shadows and like dark blue lighting of the morning before the sun comes up really gives you that creepy feel, a bit of fog rolling through the area. But as soon as the sun came up and filled the area, it was like happy and cheery and butterflies and all that.
I think as someone who's into filmmaking, cinematography, that would be a really good place to explore, just to explore cinematography because of all the shadows, the lighting, the fact the statues are kind of covered in this thin layer of moss, just look really creepy and degraded. I think it'd be a really fun place. It'd be a place to really explore yourself as a filmmaker.
And the groundskeeper was hilarious. The groundskeeper was like, oh, so you want to go like this? He's like, do you have a drone? If you have a drone, get out the drone. And I'm like, sure. And he's like, okay, so you want to try and get the drone through them as fast as you can? I swear he was trolling me. Because as I'm getting it up, I zip it through the I end up cracking one of the blades and I've got to change the blade. Right. And he's like, I'm actually really impressed that you did that. And I'm like, why? He's like, because the last guy I recommended to do that crashed his drone right into the back of one of the things. It just destroyed it.
Brilliant. Some sort of evil demon, like, this person.
He was clearly trolling. He wanted to see me crash the drone.
Sabotage was his game. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Kind of like that guy who crashed the drone into the wall of a cliff.
I wonder who that was. I wonder who could have done that. It was me, wasn't it? Oh, that was such a shame. Yes. Going back to the beautiful remote cave with the awesome photo of Norm that should be his profile photo. I got my drone out, got some beautiful shots. And then as I was coming into land, I started landing it on the beach and the wave just sort of came up the beach really quickly and I had to retake off. I had to take the drone off again just to avoid the water. And it sort of veered off into the cliff wall and destroyed. And just that was that. And it was a terrible shame.
It's okay. I make excuses too. It's fine.
And actually, that it died. I had to go and buy a new drone after that because I replaced the blades, but I think the motor was buggered. So I got a lot out of that Mavic Air. It performed brilliantly on journey across Japan. I must have made like 30, 40 videos with it. It never let me down until I killed it. But I recently bought a Mavic Mini, and it's like a fraction of the size of the Mavic Air. It doesn't do 4K, it does 2K. But the quality is insane and it's so small. And I highly recommend it. This video is sponsored by Mavic Mini, DJI. No, it's really good though. Honestly, it blew me away. And I'm kind of holding out for the next DJI Mavic Pro Series drone, Pro 3.
But yeah, when the Pro 3 comes out, It's gonna. I didn't grab the Pro 2 because whatever the next one's gonna be, it's obviously. But the 2 is still so popular that there's not enough pressure on them. So on film gear, I think it's a fair one considering that we both put a lot of effort into and time into our production, and we really enjoy the process of shooting and editing. And just, do you have a particular piece of gear that you enjoy working with the most?
That's a good question. I quite like my camera, the Panasonic GH5. I used to shoot on a Canon 70D, which is the one. I know you've got the successor to that, the 80 or 90D. What have you got at the moment?
Yeah, I've got both.
Oh, big spender. Both cameras. That's just great.
You got to have a backup because they will die.
I moved to the GH5 because you can do 4K 60 and I wanted to do 4K. Mm. I shoot in 4K and render it out at 1080 so I can punch in without losing any image quality, right?
Yeah.
If you combine the GH5 with the Sigma Art lens, 18 to 35, which goes as low as like 1.2, you can get really good low light cinematic shots. It's a beautiful camera. It's done me. It's got the best like stabilization in it. Like if you walk steadily with it, you can get almost gimbal like quality because there's stabilization in the lens and the camera. And as a filmmaker, you're looking to kind of get rid of those constraints, right? Like I do have a DJI. Well, I can't remember which one it is. The DJI gimbal. The one for the camera. I just don't use it because the camera's already really well stabilized, the camera I'm looking at now.
Yeah.
And so you can walk with it and you're looking to just get rid of those constraints. You don't want anything. You just want the camera and some ideas and off you go. Only thing that's bad is the autofocus. Absolute, can we swear?
why don't you go for it?
Absolute fucking shit show. Damn you, Panasonic. If you'd sorted out that autofocus, it'd be the best camera in the world. Everyone knows this. But because the autofocus is unusable, it's a big blow. And I'm looking to switch to the Canon EOS R5, which is coming out somewhere between April and June. And that will be a game changer because I can finally get some really high quality cinematic shots full frame. I don't want to go on about equipment too much because I know a lot of you guys listening to this probably don't care about equipment, probably more interested in Japan. But yeah, I think from June we're going to see a bump in quality on the picture quality in the videos. You can shoot in 8K. Nice. 8K. Yeah. Imagine that. Abroad in Japan, 8K. You can see my stupid face in incredible resolution that your internet won't be able to handle. The most pointless resolution. I don't even see the point in 4K to most of the time, let alone 8 bloody K, but it'll be fun.
Outside of just punching in, one of the big things is, like, I've recently, I don't think we've had a chance to talk about this yet, but I've recently partnered with Blackmagic.
You lucky rascal.
The creators of the Pocket Cinema camera.
Amazing camera.
And the biggest benefit.
I hate you, though. I hate you. You get, like, all the deals, GoPro, Blackmagic, everything. Like, oh, do you want a free camera? Yeah, I'll take it. Send them my email address. Get abroad in Japan some free stuff. That is a great camera.
It's
though.
Kind of funny because we were sitting down and you're like, you had said, you know, by naming the channel Tokyo Lens, you've kind of given this feel to it that there's a gear or like a camera like feel to it, right? It was literally the next day that GoPro reached out to me.
Need to change my channel abroad in Japan Lens and get the free equipment that I deserve. No, I think obviously, because you do talk about cameras and photography quite a lot, and I've always associated your channel with that, and that's what I found your channel so interesting. It wasn't just another Japan vlog. You know, you talked about cameras, you were passionate about photography and cinematography. So you deserve those cameras. Well done. And send me some free equipment. But
the big, big benefit that I think a lot of people don't realize with a 4K, 6K, or for example, 8K camera, if you're shooting with an 8K camera, the 4K that you get out of that camera will be so much cleaner than 4K from a normal 4K camera.
Absolutely.
Like, you'll be able to do a 400% crop and actually see detail that you wouldn't see on a 4K camera, which is a huge, huge benefit. And one of the biggest reasons why people shoot on the high resolution cinema cameras, but still export all of their stuff to 1080, because full production,
absolutely.
Full production productions will also export in 1080, but shoot as high as 4 to 8K just because it gives you a much cleaner image. I also cannot wait to get my hands on that new Canon R5.
That is the essence of full productions. I mean, another reason I shoot in 4K is I downscale it, right? Where you shrink it down to 1080p, but it's oversampled with loads of pixels, so it gives it a sort of clean, sharper image. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to Tokyo Lens 8K. That beard, you'll be able to see your entire beard, Norm, in a resolution that's unthinkable until now. It'll be the next level.
I actually recently accidentally exported and uploaded two videos in 4K, and it just goes to show how little that matters, because not a single person at all noticed that anything was in 4K.
No, so. Absolutely. People always ask, when it comes to YouTube, doing, you know, having a good channel, what's the main thing to look for? And the main thing is always content. Like, some of my most popular videos, I've shot on my iPhone, I've shot on a crappy Samsung Galaxy. Content is always the key to success. I don't want to use the phrase content is king. I hate that phrase. But content is the main factor in deciding your success. Equipment really is second best. You know, I see a lot of good YouTubers who have the best resolution, cinematic shots, lighted like a Hollywood film, but they just don't present in an interesting way. They don't script the videos well. They don't think about what they're going to say or what they're giving to the viewer. Tangible, educational, entertainment benefit, there's none. So, like, yeah, absolutely. It's good to have great equipment. It's always fun, but at the same time, never forget that content is key, but not king. Content's king. I hate that phrase.
There's actually one video that I wanted to ask about, because speaking of gear and all of these things, there's a video this past year that I know that you put an incredible amount of work into. like above and beyond among the rest. And it was a documentary project that you did centered around one very specific spot in Tohoku.
I've done two documentaries recently in the last 6 months about Tohoku. One of them on the kind of earthquake and tsunami and how they recovered, and the other one on Fukushima and what, you know, the past, present, and future situation of Fukushima. And yeah, that was a real test for me. I only had like 2 days to shoot, but it, you know, when you've got a good camera, GH5, Sigma Art lens, kind of cinematic lens, combined with a drone, that's all you need to tell a really powerful story. And the stories we had, you know, the guy who had a farm, where he keeps his cows alive because he likes the cows, and the government asked him to slaughter them because obviously they were irradiated to the, but he vowed to keep them alive. That was an incredible story. But yeah, it really challenged me and pushed me as a filmmaker. And I was gutted when it first came out because, for whatever reason, it didn't do well on YouTube, which surprised me. I thought, you know, Fukushima as a topic is quite... people tend to engage with that. But I think YouTube blacklisted it or had something pop up on it because it had, like, disaster, Fukushima, nuclear, had some really kind of dicey keywords. And so I contacted YouTube and said, what's going on with this video? They said, oh, we don't know. And then mysteriously after that, views did pick up. So I think it must have had something automatically put on it. But it did pick up. It's now got almost, it's on track for 700,000 views, which is good in my view. It is a big 25-minute documentary as well. And it's a miracle to get people to watch anything over about 12 or 14 minutes on YouTube. It's always a challenge. So... But yeah, I'm proud of that. I waited many years to do the Fukushima video, given I live relatively nearby, about 2 hours north of Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility, and it was worth the wait.
Documentary work, I don't think people realize just how much work is put in the edit, in arranging all the footage and finding a story and telling the story. It's a very, very exhausting and involved process. Like, even a 10-minute documentary that I put together recently took me 15 straight days of just non-stop editing. So something like that, 25 minutes on such a big and heavy topic, I was just sitting there going, wow, okay, all right. So we went that way with that, did that with that. How did you feel? Did you feel more satisfaction personally in the process of creating or on the final completion?
It's a tough one, really. Probably at the end of it, I kind of sat, but by the end of it, I was wrecked because it did take, we filmed it in 2 days and I edited it in about 10 days. And it was relentless from, you know, I scripted it out, did the voiceover, filmed it, color graded it, cut it together. There was like 4 or 5 different interviews to put in. I spent a whole 2 days probably looking for the music alone. And I think music is key in a documentary. That it really kind of helps tell the story. And I had some really ominous music at first. And it was like... I was like, this isn't appropriate. It's not a horror film. I need to, you know... Because if you look at a lot of videos people have made on Fukushima, they play out the horror aspect. And, you know, it is horrifying. But at the same time, I didn't want to glorify that. But no, at the end of it all, sitting down now, I can forget about all the hell that I put into making it. And with any documentary or any video where you're pushing yourself, it's always a real learning curve, right? You're always thinking, how do you film an interview? I wasn't sure. You know, I didn't know how to film things. I had to, before I went out and filmed the interview, I kind of did some research on how to do lighting and how to kind of set up the tripod on the camera in such a way that interviews look kind of easy and pleasing to the viewer, to the eye, when on camera, on screen. I looked up some techniques for how to fly a drone cinematically, because usually I just fly the drone forwards and that's it. But I did some kind of different kind of panning and tilting shots to really bring it out. The drone really helped do Fukushima justice, because you can see the sheer scale of the destruction, right? But no, I'd say to anyone who is creative in any field, when you do those projects where you're pushing yourself and it's daunting, it's a little bit scary, you really do learn quite a lot. And I've learned so much from doing projects like Fukushima, Natsuki the movie about my friend Natsuki a few years ago, Hyde, where I spent a week with Japanese rock star Hyde from Larkin CL. Those sort of projects were terrifying and very stressful, but at the end of it, I felt like I leveled up in confidence as a creator. But actually now I'm taking a step back from doing those documentaries, and I kind of just want to go back to sitting indoors, because at the end of the day, that's what viewers want. They just want to have the kind of one-to-one feel of being inside your apartment or whatever, just filming. And even though you know, those documentaries are more impressive from a production standpoint, in terms of production quality. People would just rather watch those videos. People do like the videos more. I'm just sitting inside going, I've had a bad day, I fell down the stairs, but look, I've got some coffee. Like, if it's just that, that does more, that does better than something that's serious and well-produced. So I've kind of reverted back now. I feel like I've done a lot of the things I wanted to do. I feel I can confidently film a documentary, and now I've ticked that box, I could just go back to sitting in a room and swearing. Which is what the people want, apparently.
It's what the people want, right? For anybody who doesn't know about these documentaries that we're talking about, what I'm going to do is I'm going to link both of them in the, you know, I'll put them down there with your channel, obviously, as well. That way, if you want more content and you want to get into these, and these are really, really well put together stories, I highly recommend watching them. They're going to be linked down there. Again, thank you for sharing that. Now, on a completely different topic, just absolutely changing gears on this one. Literally every single time that you and I have ever met, there has been one consistent thing that you have done. I don't even know if you realize that you're doing it every time we meet. No matter where we meet,
I'm terrified.
You recommend food or a restaurant in that exact spot. If we meet in Azabu, you're like, here, Roppongi here. If we're up in Aomori there, every spot we've been, you've recommended food or a restaurant.
Well, as someone who simply cannot cook, I'm forced to eat out literally every day, three times. So I've eaten out quite a lot, yeah. So I know a fair few restaurants, I like to think. McDonald's.
So on that note,
yeah.
It can be literally anywhere in Japan. If you had to choose perhaps one or two restaurants that people coming to Japan absolutely have to try out, just based on your personal preference, a place that maybe you like the atmosphere, the food, the surroundings, something. Do you have anything that stands out in your mind, or do you have a specific type of food that maybe stands out in your mind?
I am going to recommend you two chains. Two restaurant chains that usually the word chain is a dirty word, isn't it? You think, oh, chain. Who wants to eat a chain restaurant? But these are two chains that will change the game. They'll change your life. And the first one is Torikizoku, right? Which is a yakitori restaurant chain where you go in, you sit down, you get a little booth area, and you get a touchscreen menu. Mm. And the, you know what? I eat yakitori more than I think any other dish in Japan. And it is consistently pretty good. You get this beautifully kind of cooked chicken. It's been skewered and kind of grilled very gently. It kind of melts in your mouth. It's very juicy. You get different toppings and things. Torikizoku has never really let me down, but they are quite popular. Mm. And because it is quite reasonably priced, quite a lot of young folks are in there. But yeah, okay. I know some people hate it, but I like it. I love it. I always go to it. And the other chain restaurant is the best sushi restaurant chain by far. In fact, it's the only sushi restaurant I like to eat in, and that's Sushi Zanmai. Every other chain I've never really enjoyed. Once you've been to Sushi Zanmai, anything else just is criminal. I recently sat down with a good friend who's been to Jiro Sushi, Tsukiyabashi, was it Tsukiyabaya Sushi? I can't remember the full name, but Jiro Sushi. We all know it. It's that documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And he said, oh, it's, you know, it's really good, but the sushi at Sushi Zanmai was equally as good, you know, and it's only $30 for a decent platter of sushi, tuna sushi. And it is very good. The owner of Sushi Zanmai, Kiyoshi Kimura, who's known as the Tuna King, because he loves tuna so goddamn much, and every branch of Sushi Zanmai has him out the front holding like a fish, like some sort, it's ridiculous. But every year they bid for the most expensive tuna, bluefin tuna, Oma tuna. And the one he bid for, I think last year, was $3.1 million for a single bluefin tuna. It's publicity stunt more than anything. But no, the sushi there is exceptional. And I've dined at a ton of sushi restaurants over the years, some that have been like Michelin starred. And Sushi Zanmai is as good, if not better. I don't know why. Might be the cuts they get. Maybe it's something they marinate the tuna with, but amazing. Those two chains will see you through. I could recommend an individual restaurant, but rather than, you know, these are restaurants you can find in any place in Japan and they'll never let you down and you'll enjoy them and they are amazing. And I think they come with English menus as well. So there you go. That'll change your trip to Japan for the better.
That's beautiful. Thank you very much for those.
You're welcome.
So what we're going to do is we're going to pause this one right here. And by pause, I mean wrap up. For everybody listening, if you have questions or you have a specific topic you'd like to hear in a future episode, do not hesitate to hit either one of us up on Twitter or Instagram or any of that. We both hang out on both platforms quite a bit. Chris, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Norm Tokyo Lens.
Any final words of wisdom?
Subscribe to the Abroad Japan channel, available on YouTube now. But no, thank you, Norm. It's been a lot of fun. It's been good to chat together. And yeah, I hope we can do it again soon.
If you've been with the Tokyo Lens podcast for a while, you'll know that there are two fairly consistent themes within the content. Number one is the push for more positive thinking. It's natural for us to fall back, but it's like a muscle that keeps needing to be exercised. And the other one is the sidebars. This podcast is all about the sidebars. And going into this episode, I fully expected that the entire episode was just going to be one giant sidebar from start to finish. Pretty much every conversation that Chris and I have ever had has jumped topic, I'd say every 30 seconds or so. So it was nice to see that we were able to stay on topic just a little bit longer today and bring it home with this episode. That being said, if there are any specific topics that you would like to hear on a future episode from us, please hit either one of us up on Twitter or Instagram and let us know. It was a lot of fun. But for now, once again, my coffee cup is just about empty. So I think I'm going to grab a refill so we can kick back with the next episode. Don't forget to just take a break from the world every now and then and fill your ears and your time with something positive. Thank you so much for joining this episode of the At Home Show. And I will talk to you again real soon.